This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 339 for Wednesday, November 20th, 2019. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me this week, Mr. Brockett Vola is back. You can find him at TheCatVolver on all the social media that matters. Hello, Brockett. What's going on, man?
Hello. Not much. Just doing my thing.
Just cruising for bruising into the American Thanksgiving coming up this weekend.
That's right. Yeah. And next week we got that coming up. So it's all, yeah, or I guess now it is first Christmas in the States, because we already have the Santas and the local pharmacies being sold, like the light up moving Santas.
Oh yeah, the lawn decoration.
Christmas music on the radio. And then we have Black Friday, which is essentially at this point, Black Friday is a bigger deal than Thanksgiving in the United States, if you really kind of look at stuff, which is terrible. just depressing.
I went looking for some Black Friday deals because as I mentioned with Lou last week, I don't generally buy gifts with Black Friday. I tend to try to find some cheap, usually electronic stuff. I generally at the end of the year, I try to grab some stuff for the studio that I need at a decent price when I know I'm going to save some money. If it's not something I need in June, then I might wait until November to get it. And so I'm looking to pick up an extra monitor. Because and we'll get into this in a second, I have a new gaming PC, and so I'm looking to have a secondary monitor for it. And the issue right now is I go into Black Friday sales, and there's pre-Black Friday sales. It's like there's stuff that's on sale now that's at Black Friday prices. And then on top of that, there's what's coming up for Black Friday. And it's just, it's become wholly confusing. It's no longer just the one day with this one sale and here's our flyer. It's now like this whole month. It's like you could buy now, or you could buy next week, or you could buy the week after that. And it's just like, just put stuff on sale. Like I find it so weird that the idea behind a sale is usually a beginning and an end, you know? And so I'm really kind of surprised that they just let people do the whole month. It's the whole, you could buy this monitor now, you can buy it in 12 days. It's going to be the same price. It's not really Black Friday yet, but we're calling it Black Friday. I know it's all very over the top. But I will hopefully find a decent monitor. So this is the fun thing that I find so strange about computer monitors. And maybe it's just because it's a niche market now, but I can get a 60-inch television for $600. I can get, if I want a good monitor, it's like $400. For like a 26-inch, 27-inch monitor. That's ridiculous. Now, if I go to lower resolution, like 1920 by 1080 and something around 24 inches, it's still $150. And that's, you know, that's reasonable if I can get it on sale for maybe a little bit less. But I couldn't believe that a large gaming monitor was like $400, because televisions now are so cheap compared to what I paid years ago when I bought a big one. And I'm so surprised that those lower end monitors are not, like, with the hard drives in my computer, my new computer, they cost less than $100. These are the things that, like, you need for this machine to run. Like, you can't operate one without it, right? So it's one of those things that is just really, really surprising that a panel, a monitor, where televisions that are so large are so close in price to a computer monitor, but yet the computer monitor is such a small thing. I don't find the value, like, across the board. Like, when I bought my big 46-inch Sony TV like 10 years ago, it died a couple of years ago now, but I must have paid $2,000 for it. But that to me was like, well, it's a 46-inch Sony television. Like, I expected to pay whatever it was on Boxing Day, like $1,800 plus tax. And now it's like, you know,
Boxing Day your, I'm sorry, is that like your Thanksgiving Boxing Day?
We have Black Friday up here too. It's the same. It's across North America. Like it's kind of bled all over.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's
bled all over. It covers everything. Yeah. Okay, okay.
But Boxing Day is another big thing where they have, and it's not Boxing Day, it's Boxing Week. Because Boxing Day is a holiday here. Like everything in Nova Scotia is closed. It's the 27th through the 30th or something, or 31st is usually the Boxing Week sales. And that is, again, usually it's a lot of retail clothing stores because a lot of people have gift certificates for the mall, stocking stuffers, like all that kind of stuff. So people will go out and spend the money that they got at Christmas time on gifts for themselves because they got, you know, Christmas cards from grandma or whatever with money in it. And so that's the big thing up here. But back when I bought that TV 10 years ago, Black Friday wasn't even a thing, or wasn't a thing at least in Canada at the time. And so now if you're going to be buying televisions, it would be this coming weekend would be the weekend to get them, not not Boxing Day. I mean, they'll go on sale again, but generally the better deals are happening this weekend. But
all right, now,
yeah,
there was always an argument, though, I know, of people saying the end of the year deals were better, like post Christmas. But I'm always like, the problem is I'm not a researcher, and I don't constantly like pore over the, so unless somebody else is doing that work for me, like Black Friday, it's like so much in your face that really all I had to do, you know, cross reference like five major stores, and then, you know, at that point, if I'm missing out because I did not manage to check on, I don't know, Marshalls or Jace, you know, some like tiered down chain that I don't necessarily always check on, then that's fine. It makes me feel like that, but yeah, it's I've only gone in store on a Black Friday once. Otherwise I've done some Cyber Monday shopping.
That's where I tend to do it too, is online. Yeah. I just look to see what's online, and there are the odd times where I compare online and then I look and say, all right, well, I don't have to wait for shipping and it is cheaper in the store. So, well, I'll go and I'll buy it from the store if it's convenient. If it's something I have to go across town for, then it becomes like, well, what's my time worth? You know, because it's going to be crazy. Yeah. Like, do I want to spend 4 hours today out getting this one thing, or I can just spend the extra $15 and have it delivered? You know, it's like, well, you know, like at that point, it might be better for me to have it delivered. But yeah, so anyway, sure. All of this tech talk has sprung up because I have a new gaming PC, which got delivered on Monday. My friend John built it over the weekend, and the parts arrived, I think, late last week. And I've done this already. I did a thank you patron stream yesterday, which was Tuesday, I think. I was streaming all day, so the time and dates have all kind of bled together. It is in no small part thank you to the support that I've been getting on Twitch, and I was able to put a new machine together and now share new games with people, which is super exciting for me because several months ago when I came up with this idea, I was talking about No Man's Sky right here on the Citadel Cafe, having not played it ever. I was watching VODs of people streaming it and playing it and going like, man, now that is my kind of game. I really wish I had access to it because it's a fairly high-end game in terms of graphics and what's needed. And it was PC only. And I've been gaming on a Mac for the last little while. And so now that I have a PC, there's a number of things that are now accessible to me, and like accessible in a cheap way. Like some of the games that I'm looking at, that I'm looking at trying, are $30. Like it's not, you know, that's what I paid for No Man's Sky. I bought it on sale back in August when they released the new version, and they dropped the price in half because the main game had been out for a couple of years. So they put the whole thing on for $30. It's like, I know I will get $30, you know, out of No Man's Sky, no problem. And so I launched it last night, pardon the pun. It was a late night stream, and I can tell you right now, I can see myself spending a lot of chill evenings playing and streaming No Man's Sky. It's got that kickback kind of experience that I was hoping for. with my Minecraft stuff that I stream, I tend to try to have it be more upbeat. It's more engaging. There's more back and forth with the chat room. A lot of the times I'm turning those VODs into YouTube videos. So there's a lot more. It's kind of like being on a podcast, right? You have to be on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? With No Man's Sky, it's I'm sitting in the same position, but it's like the lazy boy experience of like kick back, cruise around space, choose a planet to land on, see what's there, scan some stuff, you know? And
yeah.
And there's no bad guys. So it's like Minecraft in that there's not like this immediate threat all the time. And so it's nice in that like your suit might be running low on oxygen or something, but it's not like you're fighting off bad guys and things are always out to kill you and all this kind of stuff. So I really, really quite enjoyed it. And I'll include a clip here in the show notes. I captured the very first moment of taking off in the No Man's Sky Starship. You have to repair it. It's a survivor game, kind of like to get you started. And so you have to rummage around, collect some minerals, repair the starship. And then when it's all finished, this is okay. Find the answers that you're seeking in the stars because your ship has been repaired and well, this is a dusty rock. We should probably leave. And so you take off and you get to fly. And what I found so compelling about this game is that when you transition from planet to space, it's not a loading screen. Like you fly into the atmosphere and then you just fly up until you leave it. And then you're in space and then you're in the solar system. And it's the same thing. You can travel at light speed between planets. And then when you approach a planet, you fly down towards it. You burn through the atmosphere. There's the re-entry fire on the cone of your ship. And then you're in the atmosphere. And they do it so seamlessly that you don't really feel like there's been a pause or a break when you know that there has been, but it feels so seamless. It really does feel like you're entering down into a new world. And so I discovered a bunch of planets like last night with the chat room and like, it was just really, really fun. And, it's a really interesting just experience of flying around. And yes, you have some mission objectives, like, you know, build a base computer and like, you know, you've got these steps that you have to go through, both of which are to teach you how to play, but also kind of progress you through the point where you can find a star base and venture out into the vast universe. But there's just something really satisfying for that first time flying around this new star system that you got dropped into and be just like, well, I don't know what's on that ice planet. Let's go find out. Because it's not necessarily something, at least so this far in the game, and I doubt that they would do this to new players because then no one would want to play, but you're not going to jump out of the cockpit on this ice planet and die immediately. So you know you can at least land, look around, scan some stuff, and realize, oh, okay, this is really hostile. Like, it's minus 100 degrees. We should probably not stay here long. Or you can get out there and be like, okay, well, it's fine. It's not hostile. It's not killing me. But wow, is it boring? Like, there's nothing but dust and rocks. And you're just like, okay. So you can mine some stuff and then go. And it's just, it's one of those things that it sounds boring when you describe it, but it's incredibly fulfilling when you're actually in charge. Like when you're behind the joystick of the spaceship. And so I'm really excited to kind of have that kind of experience in a game, something where I'm not like running around shooting stuff or try not to die or whatever, you know, the usual suspects, you know, are of
space marine. Of the galaxy.
Exactly.
Type of stuff. Yeah.
Pardon me. Exactly. So yeah. And
it's more interstellar. Like,
yes. You know. Yeah. Yeah. It's more of a laid back thing. Have you played any games like that? Or do you stick to more like a straight up, console gaming, more like, you know, Halo and Assassin's Creed and Batman, that sort of thing?
I personally don't like to play with other people online, which
I don't blame
on a
you.
Minor note, I'm a major Diablo person.
Okay.
So the Diablo 4 announcements about it being always online has really worried me. And on the flip side, my favorite franchise, Borderlands 3, did not go the Destiny route loot shooter that everyone thought it was potentially going to go, and stuck very hard to the sort of single player experience being important, which is great. I've not played that yet. I'm waiting for the holidays, but it's definitely for those experiences. I don't like to interact with other people that much, so something like this sounds good. But the closest thing I get to this, I've started a few, I guess they're called walking. I forget what they're called. They're like walking games or so. Basically ones where all you do is like, you just walk kind of, you move through the game, but you don't, there's not like a lot of like puzzle solve or anything. You kind of just move around. I forget which ones I've started, but the closest thing I would say is probably adventure games. I actually started one today. Thimbleweed Park. In the same vein, if people are familiar with like the Monkey Island games or some of the LucasArts games, for Indiana Jones, and like Telltale games are sort of like this, but even less like reactionary, more like point and click, you know, pick up, give, push, pull, mix these two objects together, that sort of stuff. That's the closest thing I would come for the most part. It's very tame. Even there was a joke in this game I just played where they're basically like break the fourth wall, and they're like, oh well, no, at no point would developers create a game where you could definitely have permanent death. You'll just sort of work around these sort of things. So it's just one of those things where, yeah, like you, the game's allowing you to sort of figure things out along the way, and things can change and that sort of thing. And I think that's the closest thing I've come with the adventure games. Of course, and those, there's usually one or two puzzles where like it just drives you so nuts, but yeah, I have never played like a flight simulator or anything like that. I haven't played like Myst or anything either, which is also very like just move around, although of course there's some hostilities in those games too, but yeah, I've heard about No Man's Sky, and one of my friends got it and liked it quite a bit, but he's playing in VR. So that was probably one of the things he was really excited about. Yeah,
I would really like to try that. I've watched a streamer, Tangent is a streamer that I follow, and we'll check out his streams from time to time. And he was one of the people that I was watching play Beyond when it first came out, because he had played the game quite a bit when No Man's Sky first came out. He played the last expansion. And so when the new expansion came out and made all these changes, he thought, okay, let's try this out, because it has full VR support. It's not a version. It's you get to play No Man's Sky in VR. It's just it's VR ready. And
yeah,
something I do find a little bit restrictive, and you can adjust this in the game settings. I was excited to play last night, so I didn't really play around with all the different options. But the field of view in the suit and in the ship is fairly restrictive, and it makes sense in the ship because like you're in a cockpit. And you also have a visor on and stuff like that. But you can change the angle and how much you can see. But I find I don't want to do that too much, because when it gets too far outside of your regular field of view, it starts to feel kind of, not cheaty, but like it feels like you're playing a game as opposed to looking through a visor and the experience there. But what he was doing, and I thought that was really interesting that he had a webcam when he did the VR stream, is that not only was he able to turn his head, so he'd be flying in a straight line and he could look out the cockpit sideways and like look at the ground and be like, oh, that's an interesting feature. I should land over there. Whereas for me, when I play the game without VR, I have to turn the ship around to see what was over there, right? Like I actually have to fly in a loop to see what's going on, where he can just look around freely. Well, just like when you're driving a car and you have to look over your shoulder before you pass someone, right? It's the same idea. And it was really, really cool because I got to see his head moving in his cam, his face cam with the VR goggles on, and then see what he was seeing as he was looking around in the game. And it was really, really neat. The other thing that he had going on, which I don't remember whether it was part of, I don't think it was No Man's Sky. I think it was part of the VR setup that he was using. He actually had his Twitch chat floating inside of VR space like a widget. So he would keep it like up out of the way, like to the top right, so that when he's playing the game and looking around, it would be unobstructed. You could see everything full screen. But then when he wanted to check to see what people were doing in the chat room, he would just look up and left. And there it was hanging in the sky in his HUD, you know, like it was
weird.
It was really cool. And I don't know whether, I don't think it was part of the game. I think it was part of the abilities of that particular headset. I think he had an HTC Vive. Anyway, very, very cool. I'm looking forward to it. The thing about the flight sim part of it is that it's not so much a flight sim, because like you're using a mouse and a keyboard to fly the ship. And so WASD is pretty common for most computer games for directions, but in the ship, it's W and S are speed up and slow down, not up and down. And I keep on wanting to try and change the pitch of my ship with my keys, and it doesn't work. You know, like you go to fly up and you end up slowing down. You have to move your mouse around. So it's a little bit strange. I feel like it would be a really good thing with No Man's Sky to have like an Xbox controller nearby. And then when you when you do jump into the ship, just grab the controller and fly with the joysticks. I feel like that would be a much better experience. Or if you had a flight stick, like if you had a joystick handy anyway, then that would be cool too. But yeah, it's a little bit tricky in that respect.
Can I ask you a question? And this comes up often. Are you an inverted axis person?
With a joystick, yes. With a with a mouse, no.
Okay, so you do it where you lean, you push forward to go up, or you push forward to look down?
If it's a joystick, I'm gonna push down on the joystick to go down. I'm gonna push forward on the joystick to go down. If I'm using a joystick, if I'm using a mouse, and this is because of how I draw, then it works the same as a mouse would on a computer screen. If I want to go up to the top of the screen with my mouse, regardless of what I'm doing, I want to push the mouse forward on the mat. Like that's
forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
So first person shooters, I don't flip the axis. And I'm pretty sure. Yeah. When I play Xbox games, I don't flip the axis either. So even though it's a joystick, it's a thumb joystick. It's not like a, it's not a flight sim joystick.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's what I do. My friend Jeremy always inverts it, and I remember when I was first ever playing a video game in which it had it. It was a nightmare. I couldn't do it. I had to do the way where, like, if I push up on the joystick, my character will look up.
Yeah.
If I push down on a joystick, my character will look down. Not the you force the yeah. Like it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
To wrap my head around that. So I always think about that whenever there's any kind of motion controls and flying a spaceship through space.
Yeah.
I can often see it'd be an extreme detriment to myself and my ship.
Yeah.
Forget which one's up or down.
The starter ship that you get with No Man's Sky is not fast nor agile. So when you're moving it with a mouse, it's really like you move the mouse an inch to the right and your ship goes, okay, let's go that way. Like it's a really, you're not going to fly in circles. You're not going to be, I don't want to run into anybody in a dogfight because I don't imagine it's going to go very well. So I've seen other ships though that are much faster that turn a lot more. And it's too bad that it's so swimmy. It does feel like a little bit restricted, but again, the idea is that it's your first ship. You're playing the game for the first hour. They kind of want to gate some things and kind of get you beyond that. It's been a long time since I've had a really good flight sim. Although I have to say, way back when I was playing the Transformers Cybertron games on Xbox, and there was an online component to one of them. I don't remember which one. And when you were playing as any of the Decepticons or even the Autobots, I guess, that had flight capabilities when you were in vehicle mode, I really enjoyed those controls. It was really fast and arcadey. And because of the whole like transforming thing and because they implemented it in the game and they had to keep it quick, it felt very dramatic. Like you could jump, transform, fly 200 meters and then transform again and land and like use your vehicle mode to transcend obstacles and get behind enemy lines, but then turn into a robot and kick some butt. And it was really, really cool. I quite enjoyed that kind of flight control because it wasn't forward momentum. You were essentially a helicopter. Even when you were a jet, you always had like reverse jets and you could turn on a dime. You could flip yourself. Like there's all these different things because it was so futuristic. Whereas this, if you want to turn around, like you got to make a giant loop. Like it's not like you can flip your ship and turn sideways, right? So,
well, that's how real space.
Well, yes,
like,
of course.
That's, you know, you can't bank in space. Like it makes no sense to Star Wars films. But at the same time, like that's fun and escapism. Whereas this type of game, I would kind of hope that if you don't, you're not being shot down by a superstar destroyer, that they would put a little bit more, you know,
yes,
thought into sort of the maneuverability, because that's probably what you're approaching it more.
Yeah,
for,
and there's no drama to push you to the point of needing to bank at that speed. Like when you're approaching a planet, you're in full control, and you can land anywhere you want, and there's no time limit. So like really cruising around at the lowest speed limit until you find something like, oh, that looks like a nice place to sit down. And I even tried a couple of times when I was exploring to just kind of like get used to it and not just land wherever, but actually try to purposely slowly kind of come in and land in a place where I wanted to and try to actually get the ship into a position. It's a lot harder than it looks. But it was fun because like you land and then you're like, all right, well, that looked flat from above, but it's not. Your ship's on like a hillside, like 45 degree angles. I mean, it's landed fine. It's a successful landing. And something I like about it is that you just have to get within certain distance of the ground and hit the E key, and it's just like landing sequence initiated, and just kind of it takes control and it just does the whole thing. It does the dramatic, like, you know, straight down, you know, hovercraft
it's
land.
It's the rear view camera Mercedes Benz, like the car moves, yeah. And you're like, I've nailed this. Yeah. Thank you, ship. I shall drink my tea.
Yeah, land now. Beep. You know exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Take the wheel.
So that's what's been going on in my small screen the last few days. What have you been watching on yours? Anything interesting?
I have been, it's funny you should mention space, because trying to segue tie in, as a part of the new HBO series Watchmen, if you are slightly familiar with the movies or the comic, I will say going into it, you should probably be more familiar with the comic.
Okay.
It is basically directly tied off of the events of the comic book, which doesn't change too much dramatically for the overall arc of the main story. If you've seen Zack Snyder's film versus read the comic book, you know a good gist of it. It's just a very climactic, I'll say, some of the climactic choices and some of the like reveal stuff is tweaked dramatically from comic to movie. Personally, I thought the movie, the way they did it, I thought was very smart, and it actually kind of worked quite a bit. And I've read stuff, you know, about both and the big hubbub about each. And I'm actually an apologist for the film. I don't think it's perfect, but I also don't think the comic is absolutely perfect. I know a lot of people definitely feel that way about it, but basically the gist is this: whether you know Watchmen or not, there was a world that had superheroes in it. This world now doesn't really have superheroes anymore because of basically an act that was put out, and then some big event happened in the world that is sort of a 9/11-esque event that has sort of centered the entire global consciousness around something, sort of a climactic thing. And because of that, there's a new status quo. Well, the series takes place, the book and the movie goes through that whole event, and then it sort of ends there with very, very little flash forward. This is pretty much, I think, 7 to 9 years later, after the events of the comic. It might be even more, it might be decades. I missed, and I was gonna look back up again, but you do need to know the gist of the world of Watchmen enough that you will get some of the references. However, I will say I'm 5 episodes in. The 5th episode does some really important groundwork stuff. If you never read the comic books in particular, but if you never read Watchmen either, up until this point, little bits and pieces of the original story are sort of brought out, mostly as sort of fun reference / Easter egg / actually used for the plot, which is important, while at the same time informing the audience that may have never read or seen the comic of the original story. And by the 5th episode, I will say they got to really explaining some of the meat of the finale of the comic. to a point where I think you will have at least probably spark notes. You can kind of measure out what the original comic book's full plot arc is through those first five episodes of the series. It doesn't blow by blow. It definitely does not like say, and no, this is what happened in these, because there's literally no reference to a couple characters at all thus far. But some of the bigger ones, and what makes me think of No Man's Sky, is Dr. Manhattan is a presence that's mentioned from the get-go, who is, if you know nothing about Watchmen, you've probably seen at least a picture of the giant blue man, either naked or not. The film famously is known for the blue penises. That's in the comic. It basically, this atomic man, through a horrific science experiment, gets morphed into essentially, no other word for it, sort of like a god. He kind of exists out of time, in time, has all these amazing powers, basically, of like, he can essentially do almost anything. But over time he sort of loses the sense of humanity and whatnot. So he's a big presence in the show, at least from the point of like literally in one TV screen, they show like this blue figure on Mars and they're talking about Dr. Manhattan, which again, there's a whole bunch of small things. There's a few characters, that you will probably recognize, Dr. Manhattan, obviously, but there's also a few references to some other characters from the comic, that if you've read them, you'll know. If you don't, it's not important unless that character is important, and then you'll just come to know that character in general. So the setup from the get-go, besides all the background, is that you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and basically there's this group called the 7th Cavalry, who's been putting on Rorschach masks, and which legitimately I have yet to find their connection to the original Rorschach, other than them wanting to put on masks because they're really white supremacists, and they're in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they're doing white supremacist stuff, and they disappeared for about 3 years, and then they reappeared on the scene. And the Tulsa police are trying to sort of combat their presence in their city. The interesting part about it is there aren't superheroes, but as part of the protection because of a big event that happened in the past, the police of Tulsa wear masks. So they're not superheroes, but they are superheroes in the sense of like they have to hide their identity as law enforcement to protect themselves when they're not on duty.
Interesting.
From nefarious situations. So you see cops with these like yellow like scarf things that covered like their nose and bottom half, and then some of the quote unquote like detective levels in the Tulsa Police Department are actually sort of, they're essentially superheroes. There's Sister Knight, there's Red something, I forget his name, there's Looking Glass, who has like a reflective, shiny, full face sort of thing. And one other person, I didn't get her name. But so it's interesting because there's not supposed to be superheroes, but the Tulsa Police Department is, beat cops have the uniform with a mask, and then the detective levels are like essentially on the book superheroes. So it's interesting because you go into it thinking, because I had heard ahead of time, like, it's like the whole thing of Watchmen was like, who watches the Watchmen? Like, no superheroes and that sort of thing. So I was wondering what they're going to do to sort of set up a world where they can have superheroes again. Well, they sort of didn't, but then did. And what's interesting, Damon Lindelof, one of the two main writers from Lost, and then he went on to have a very successful run with the Leftovers on HBO, is the main sort of brainchild behind this Watchmen series. He's definitely gone, I would say, 89% like faithful to feel and tone of Watchmen. But, and I think this is important, you need at least enough license within your own thing not to be a complete nostalgic or really beholden to the original material. I think sometimes the Zack Snyder thing was trying too hard to do that, And so when you try and, you know, when you try and stick too close to something that comes before, you end up with something like Superman Returns, which feels very familiar, but then doesn't really stand out by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think Lindelof does a really good job. I've had a lot of fun watching with Laura, who's seen the Zack Snyder film, but not read the comics. So you only get, even though the film, I think, is almost 3 hours, but like, you only really get the basic plot, but a lot of the meaty character bits and some of the complete side stories of the comic are completely cropped from the film, because you just can't at that time you weren't really allowing yourselves to go over 3 hours in the movie theaters.
No, exactly. Not to mention that for people that may in the listening audience may not be familiar, Watchmen is a graphic novel. Like it's a large,
right? Sorry,
it's a big read, and so there's just no way. It's similar to when a novel gets changed into a film. Like you cannot fit everything. You have to trim something.
Right, yeah, and it's a full 12 issues, which, you know, equates to 12 months worth of work put in together, and originally Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons did it, and Alan Moore, of course, as his wishes with everything that gets adapted, took his name off of it, but that was another way where it sort of was like, you know, it was funny, because I think there's been a lot of talk going into it where Lindelof is essentially saying, you know, or respect what's there, but then, you know, also like death of the author, this is its own thing. So I'm interested to see where some things are changing. I will say, up to this point, I really feel like, and I'm not the writer, but I like to write, and I really feel like this is probably kind of like doing a pretty good service to the original content of the story. I would say only one character that I've seen so far that's deeply tied to the original story is a little bit more, I don't want to call screwball, but a little bit more eccentric than I had foreseen in the original comics. But anyway, it's been really fun. It's got enough different things going on, mysteries in a very lost Lindelof sort of manner. There's stuff that sort of characters talk about on screen that you don't have context for. So you're not getting the full story until moments later or episodes later. There's still ongoing mysteries throughout the season. So it's a good show if you have been wanting like a really solid, see, it, to me, it scratches the itch of what I loved early on about Westworld, which was sort of high concept, nice, interesting world.
Mm.
But I am worried the same way I have now become with Westworld, where at some point the concept and the peculiar mystery elements of the series get to a point where you're like, all right, well, what else is there? Once I've seen the man behind the curtain, like what else is there for me? So I'm interested to see what's gonna happen. They've already done some stuff, some reveals throughout the first five episodes that make me feel like, all right, I'm excited that they're not gonna just keep drawing out certain things. But then I also have that nervousness that I have with some recent TV shows that have been amazing out the gate, like Good Place and the first season of Flash. But at some point, you know, you just, unless you have an end date in mind, like at some point you're only going to have so many different magic tricks in your bag. So far it's going well. It's got a good cast. It's got Jeremy Irons, Regina King, Don Johnson, I'm gonna blank his name, but I like him quite a bit. I think his last name's Blake. I should have just pulled it up on IMDb. If you're familiar with Oh Brother Where Art Thou or The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, I guarantee you you've seen this guy before. He even played a small part in The Incredible Hulk. He played Buster Scruggs in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, but he's a big part of the series thus far.
Who was he in Incredible Hulk?
Incredible Hulk, he was the goofy scientist that they kind of set up to become a mastermind.
Yes, I know who he is. Yeah. I know who he is.
Yeah. He's not Totoro. He's not Clooney. He's the third guy in Oh Brother Where Art Thou, basically. Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, so, and he's in it, and I feel like I'm missing one other big person. I'm trying to pull some up, but Jean Smart's in it, she's also fantastic. So it's like, it's one of those shows where you see people in it and you're kind of like, oh, that person, but like it's a collection of really solid writing, and it's like I always feel like with good movies or television shows, what you do is you don't cast the actor first. You write the story and then you find the person that fits the part best. And
yes.
I feel like we've all felt that best with the way they've done some Marvel stuff. And and Pixar, I feel like, does that all the time where they don't, like, notoriously, I think DreamWorks made the Sinbad cartoon pre-getting Brad Pitt. And I think Angelina Jolie and somebody else, like, as big name actors, and then just kind of threw the rest of it on top of it. Like, you get the story first, then you get the people.
Yeah.
And so I think they did that with this because, you know, I think most people don't know who Regina King is necessarily right off the bat. But if you look up her work, you'll see all sorts of stuff. I'm pretty sure she might have even won an Emmy for recently some of the work she did on American Crime Story. But she's basically the main character. She's one of these Tulsa detectives. She plays Sister Knight. And you get to see a lot of the events of the past few years in Tulsa and even the long, dark history of some of the race issues in Oklahoma. I will say, definitely an HBO show, to the point where less it's been about the nudity that you're associating with HBO. I mean, there's some nudity, but to me, it's more the graphic nature of things. Like, it has a harsh, cold open, Watchmen does, pretty harsh. And to the point where my wife and I looked up afterwards to see if that was fact or fiction. The cold open takes place in the 1920s. Anyway, it's just one of those things where a lot of the pieces in it, I think, are very fun and interesting and engaging the less you know. But if you were nervous about coming to this because you've never read or taken in Watchmen, I think you can get into it. They'll set up the pieces of the world that they need you to know. And if they don't right away, the fun thing I think for you might be is finding out things from the original story, like the characters are finding out things, you know, like you're not coming into it knowing, oh yeah, I was behind the curtain the whole time. I know all these secrets that the world or these people don't know about. Instead, you're kind of finding out along the way. If you are a big fan of the comic book or even just the Zack Snyder film, I think you could also enjoy it. I was very nervous about it going into it, but I think it helped that by the time we watched it, 4 episodes were out. So we kind of kept going. And I think sometimes with TV series now, I kind of like that little extra 3 to 4 episodes to start and then go weekly if I have to, because right. Then you really have a good solid foundation for the show. And you don't necessarily right off the bat are like, do I want to watch this? Do I have time for this? So I give it a good solid thumbs up. It has the same sort of prestige as you would imagine from HBO show. The quality of the lighting, the work, the music, everything is really, really good.
So I'm not a big fan of the Zack Snyder film, but I didn't like the graphic novel. So it doesn't surprise me that I wasn't a big fan of the film. I think the problem that I have with it is just like, it's so anti-hero that for me, it just doesn't sit well. Not to say that it's bad. It's more like it's not my thing, but
it's bleak.
Yeah. But I'm curious, when you've removed superheroes and then you're in this world where it's not a thing anymore, and you have the masked police officers and stuff, that's where I find it starts to get interesting. So it's no longer like a superhero show, because those expectations are set from the start. And I feel like that's a little bit, I mean, it's darker, but it's still an exploration that I would be curious about, because when you've got good writing like that, like if that seems to be the focus, that to me would pull me into a world that's grim, even though that may be not my normal cup of tea.
Yeah, I will say it's more noir than The Flash or CW show.
Oh, yeah.
And it's far more grounded, street level people. Dr. Manhattan exists, but even in the original novels, I will say that it felt like it was essentially a whole bunch of Green Arrows running around next to like Superman. And that sort of still feels the same way. As far as I've seen, I've not seen somebody who can like use mine bullets or like curves an arrow to shoot to the moon. Like that has not come into play thus far.
Yeah.
There's definitely big concepts, big sciencey stuff. And I will say I was worried about the bleakness of it. Because I'm not a big, I mean, you and I are on record as being Superman fans. Yeah. And I feel like Watchmen was one of those first big things along with the Dark Knight Returns of this new era of like, we got to tear down the Superman icon because that's, you know, blah, blah, yeah, all the stuff behind it, whatever. But I'm like, I always bought into the idea of hope and that sort of thing. So I even remember reading the original Watchmen. My two buddies were so jacked about it. And I love the mystery of it, but I was deeply disappointed in the characters of it because of what they were like and what this world was like. And I get it. There's a lot more reality to it, but it's the reason why I very, very, very against something like The Boys. I first and foremost, I'm not a big fan of Garth Ennis, but I also just don't, I just really don't care about people being like Supermans are or superheroes are garbage. They're all trash people. I get it. That's a cool meme for that sort of thing. But I love Superman. I love My Hero Academia, which is about young superheroes in school. Like that sort of stuff is cool to me. And I can get excited for that. And I can find bleakness in the circumstances they have to fight, but not in the people. Like I never was into Breaking Bad because again, it felt so bleak. So yeah. I definitely feel thus far there's not a ton of bleakness, Joel, but I will say that it, and there is some levity to it in some of the characters. I will say Jeremy Irons kind of makes me like smile in a weird, like, Jeremy, is this Jeremy Irons? Like, it's just weird. He does a great job, but his character is very interesting. So, for that reason, I think it's probably slightly more optimistic at this point, but it's film noir level. It's still going to have some, you know, film noir is never like, Superman would never be in a film noir necessarily.
No, and but you know, the thing when stuff goes so far as to be film noir, because of that kind of genre, it sets you up, it sets your expectations. Whereas you get into something like Carnival Row, which does feel a little film noir, but because it's still presented in a modern sort of way, it just feels grim. Like it doesn't feel like a retro separated universe, even though that's exactly what it is. It feels really, that's what I'm looking for. I mean, visceral is one, but the thing about Carnival Row, it's not tongue in cheek. Like there's no voiceover. There's no monologuing. Yeah. Like, I mean, the gumshoe detective is not talking to himself by, you know, you don't get to hear his thoughts as the viewer. You know, like that's, so it doesn't have that kind of self-awareness, I guess is the best way to say it. Carnival Row takes itself very seriously, and that's why it is so grim, right? Whereas something like, what's the Frank Miller novel? Sin City is dark and it's film noir, but it also doesn't take itself wholly seriously
because it's the pulp side of it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Pulpy, that's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. So if you've got that, then you can kind of see it more as an artistic take than you do as a alternate reality. You know what I mean?
Right. I agree. I would rather have film noir that is pulpy than the other side. Now, I will say the first season of True Detective is fantastic, and that's not very pulpy, but it's a very good mystery story. And so if you want a straight mystery, a very good straight mystery, you can have Agatha Christie's, you can have Sherlock Holmes and that sort of thing. But if you have like the hard-boiled dick, the PI, the down on their luck, trodden film noir elements, where you're going to have cops and robbers and that sort of line. I do feel like most of the time I much prefer it when they have the pulpy side of things. There's a little bit more like wise guys in it. You got a lot of throwing jokes around when bullets are flying, that sort of thing. And, you know, you chew the scenery with your words. Like you really relish in how smart and witty and you can be. If you remove a lot of that, then you just really have something that's almost too close to reality, where you're just like, it's bleak. And it's like, wow, you know, like good guys, bad guys, there aren't any. There's just people. Mm. And like, I totally understand it. And I totally can get into people's mindsets that that's what they want to watch. But when it gets too much like that, you know, it's, I just don't want to do that as much, which is interesting because I think more in the past few years, I've seen more shows like that. They tend to be political. So I, at least I kind of gloss over it by being like, it's political fiction, even though it's probably more close to reality than anything. But
well, that's, I mean, Carnival Row is like that. The themes of immigration and racism and classism in Carnival Row are like ripped from the headlines. Like it's you're not missing the mark by too much there. But well, speaking of the more, I don't even want to say dramatic, because there's really not that much drama in this show, as there is just so much, there is a storytelling, or the drama is situational. It's not that the players involved are being dramatic. It's that they, the situations, the world events that happen in a show like what I've been watching, which is The Crown season 3, which I know is not a particularly nerdy show, although I guess there could potentially be some people out there that would consider themselves to be like nerds of the royal family and follow their every move. I am not one of them. It's not like I'm disinterested. It's just, it doesn't really affect me. I don't read the tabloids. And so like all that kind of like, I don't follow any celebrities, you know, like I don't know any of that kind of stuff outside of what Dwayne Johnson puts on Instagram. Like I don't know any of the gossip in Hollywood, because that kind of stuff just doesn't interest me. And I was too young to be really enamored when kind of like the royal family in Britain had their heyday in like the 80s sort of thing. Like that scene, like when Princess Diana was around, that seemed to be like the darling sort of situation and everybody had eyes on sort of stuff. But I really enjoyed the first two seasons of The Crown. And so I was really interested to see what they were going to do with the third, because when I heard that they were doing it, and I know that they were recasting everybody because they had fast forwarded in time, I thought, oh, wait a minute, this is going to be really different. So like, am I going to like this? Because I really enjoyed Claire Foy as Queen Elizabeth II. And I was concerned that it was going to be too different for me. And it's a very different show, but it's a very different time period. It's set in the 60s. It starts in the early 60s. I want to say 64, 66, something like that. And so the queen is an older queen, not old, but like her kids are graduating high school, or her oldest are graduating high school, going on to university and stuff like that. I think Charles is going to Dartmouth Naval Academy or something like that. So like they're in their kind of like early 20s, 20-ish sort of thing. And I have to say, like, as slow as the show is on the surface, I am just enamored through the whole episode. It's not a fast-paced show. There's no plot. There's no mystery. Like, there's no, you know, what if, what happened, what's going to happen next. It's all, because, I mean, it's really heavily, obviously, bio information. You know, they're making television shows about the royal family, many of whom are still alive. So, like, they're not, there's no fiction. There's, well, I shouldn't say no fiction. I don't know. But I don't imagine that they're pushing the envelope that much. Outside of like inserting conversations behind closed doors, which no one would know of, you know, that sort of thing, to kind of keep the pace flowing. But what I do find so interesting about it is that it is such a well-done show. And the level at which they portray the royal family and where they are, the situations, the locations, it has to be probably one of the most expensive shows that Netflix has ever made, purely because of the locations that they have to shoot this in. Now, some of it, I'm sure, is recreations. Like some of the rooms would not be the real thing. But even just like, but all of the outside shots, like even just to have the day to get your B-roll, you know, to be there must cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a minute. Like it's crazy. You know, it's like Downton Abbey. Like when you're watching Downton Abbey and there's just so much, you know, elegance everywhere. You just like, even if it's all just made up, you know, and set dressing, it's still that level of detail and ornateness, I guess, and that kind of level of state is really interesting. So that there is that kind of eye candy, and it's funny. It's not necessarily all of the people or the events. It's as much the set dressing and the experience of being there, as it is the actors. But what I find so interesting about all of this is, I actually feel like I'm learning a little bit of Britain's history, because they're fast forwarding every couple episodes. They go forward a couple of years. So it goes 64, 66. There's the whole royal family watching the moon landing in 69. And so now, I guess in the last few episodes of the season, I haven't finished it yet, but we'd be into the early 70s. It's just, it's really interesting to see like this window into the past of these major events that I missed because I wasn't live. You know, moon landing. There was one of the more moving episodes, which was interesting in a terrible way, was the Aberfan disaster in Wales. It was a mining disaster where a coal waste, I can't remember what they called them. It's basically a mountain of coal waste, and they had piled it higher than they should have. And there was a spring under it, and it got wet, and it turned into like a giant mudslide, landslide. And it took out a school full of the town's children, and like 80 kids died. Like, it was grim. And the story of the episode is how the crown, the prime minister, and the government, and how they all handled that, how they responded, didn't respond. And the theme, from what I can gather from the season, is the inability of the crown, both as its as an entity, but also as individuals. And this is like most of the royal family, not just the queen. And their inability to express or come down on a side of something, even when it is as important as the Aberfan disaster. It's like there was this hesitation of, I can't express any kind of emotion, when like really today the reaction would be like, well, of course you can and you should. But like there's this notion behind the royal family where they're just not supposed to, but you can feel the battle. Like, you can, the decisions are made and they're hard decisions, and they feel very cold from the outside, because what you get from the story is very often what the public would have seen at the time. And then later on, usually at the very end of the episode, they peel back and express like, this was one of the harder things that had ever happened. A lot of times in the episodes, they'll put up this text at the end that expresses like, so this was a long lasting friendship between these two people or whatever. And what you've seen in that episode is like how that came to be, or in the case of the Aberfan disaster. And again, I don't think this is really a spoiler, because I don't think anybody that's watching the show would maybe know this, but it remains apparently one of the deeper regrets, apparently, of Queen Elizabeth II, because of how it was handled publicly, you know, in terms of how the government and the crown responded or didn't respond, as the case may be. And I just, it's been, I was planning on watching like one a night, and I've been watching two a day. I've been watching one with breakfast and usually when I find a drama like this, it's like, great, that's my evening. That's my chill time after dinner. I'll watch one and go to bed. And I've been actually watching them in the morning, like one in the morning, and then I'll watch, you know, one in the evening. So I've gone through, it's only been a few days, and there's only 8 episodes, I think, or 10. So I've gone through, you know, all 8 or almost all 8. But what I find so interesting about the acting in it, on the surface, it feels very stiff, and some of the lines and the deliveries, especially speeches that are known, like public speeches on television, like it's probably word for word what was said, because why would you change it? But it's the subtlety of everyone involved. Olivia Colman plays Queen Elizabeth. Tobias Menzies plays Prince Philip. Helena Bonham Carter plays Princess Margaret. Charles Dance is Lord Mountbatten. And Joss O'Connor, who I didn't know, I might try to find other things that he's been in, but he plays a very young Prince Charles. And it's just impeccable acting. I mean, Charles Dance we're all pretty familiar with in a lot of different things, including being Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones. And it's one of those things where, like, I'm so used to him being a villain to see him being, he's like a stern, you know, senior British, you know, member of the royal family and former military man. So he's not, there's not a lot of warm and fuzzies falling off the guy, but he does smile from time to time, which is weird. He's just like, you're Tywin Lannister. He doesn't smile. What are you talking about? So there's these little breaks that happen in characters. Same with Tobias Menzies. Like, this is a dude that I have not seen in anything where I haven't hated his guts. Not that he's not a good actor, but he's just so good at being the villain that you just, like, he comes on the screen and you're just like, just, I just want to rip him to pieces, because in those roles, he's so good at being vile. And in this, he plays the queen's husband and he has his moments where he's not kind to other people, but they do a really good job of establishing this strange kind of loving relationship between king and queen, or prince, or Prince Philip and the queen, but also this distance that they have. It's like, it's a very 1 minute he's being very sweet, and the next minute you see them and you just, like, they don't even look like they even like being in the same room together. but it's obvious that it's there, and it's because of that lack of emotion, and the lack of expression that happens outwardly to the public is also bounced around inside the family, where, like, even when they sit down to dinner, it's like, wow, this is like the coldest, like, not shallow in that it doesn't mean anything, but like, it's the conversation just never gets personal. Like, it's all just fluff.
Yeah.
It's very, very strange. But I have to really tip my hat to Olivia Colman, who does an impeccable job of appearing at first to be cold and just immovable, immovable emotionally as a queen. And I don't know what she does. I'd have to be inside the actor's, you know, kind of like workroom to figure this out. But without apparently moving a muscle, you can still kind of feel her go from being at a normal state, a neutral state, to agitated, to furious, to happy is a little bit easier to spot. It's usually in the softer moments, like between her and her husband, or maybe when she's with horses, that you can see a smile or something like that. But there's moments where she's talking to someone like a prime minister or another family member or something like that. And I don't know whether it's like a posture change or what, but it, like, on the surface, it looks like not a muscle in her face has moved. And yet, you know that she's gone from being like an observant, you know, listening party to, I'm about to bring the smackdown. And it's just like,
yeah.
But she's not visibly angry. And it's a really subtle thing. And it's a complicated character to play as well. I say character, person's real person. But if you're into this kind of thing, if you like the royal family, I'm curious if people out there are watching this and are getting as much out of it as I am, because, like I said, I'm not a follower. I'm not like a royal fan. I find it interesting. It's odd that they still exist in kind of our current, you know, global climate, but at the same time, you know, a lot of times what they argue in the show is like, well, we don't change anything because, like, the tradition in times of unrest is everything. And in a way, I can even see that being true today, where you've got such turmoil happening all over the planet, and yet the royal family has been this steadfast thing, you know, and has had to... I think what I find so interesting about it in the 60s and the 70s is you're starting to see the beginning of the royal family struggling to maintain and try to find that place as the world changes rapidly. You know, television, electricity, computers, man on the moon. Like, I mean, this stuff is happening at a lightning pace compared to the 40s post-war, which is where they had the last two seasons. And so, yeah, like it's got that kind of a... It's got that kind of a draw of, like, history through a lens, I guess is the best way to put it. Again, not a show that's going to have you on the edge of your seat. But I know that you and Laura are really into good acting and good writing. And I say good writing because I'm assuming it is because I like it, but it's, I don't know whether it's off the truth, you know, like whether it's something that is really, really pushing the boundaries, or whether it's
how much is historical fiction and what's
embellished, that sort of thing.
What's it called again? Reenactment, sort of thing.
That sort of thing.
I mean, I found I've tried with a lot of shows, and I think what I've realized is I just don't care for historical fiction. Hmm. I like history, and there's certain things that I could potentially get into. But other than Band of Brothers off the top of my head, which again is not historical fiction, it's based off of history, but like at the same, dramatized history, but not historical fiction. I watched as much Downton Abbey as I could. I've watched Mad Men. I've watched, it just comes to a threshold where I'm like, this isn't enough for me. And the thing about The Crown that might have been is the politics of stuff, but the problem is British politics, at least in that lens, is not quite the sort of Machiavellian American politics that you see in The West Wing and House of Cards. And now I'm sort of getting economically with secession of like these like really like, it's funny, I'm gonna now say Shakespeare, which is, you know, obviously comes from the same place the royals do, but like there's a lot more like like Iagos and finger wringing and nastiness and manipulating backstabbing to some of the sort of political stuff that Laura and I tend to watch. The Crown just never gripped me. What's interesting though is hearing you talk about No Man's Sky and then talk about The Crown, and the key thing I found with both of the things you enjoyed is like it's not about the plot, it's more about a sense of something that's interesting, that's not high impact or low impact, but is just there. Mm-hmm. And in not a bad way. Sometimes that's what you want. Sometimes you just want to sit on a rocking chair and watch, you know, like literally the sun go down. Like that to some people might be boring. And again, I'm not saying that it's boring, because I'm definitely getting to an age where I'm a certain point where I'm like, man, just sitting in one place and just watching something. Like I just watch my daughter do nothing all day. That's fascinating. Right. But like, I think that's what's interesting about both of those shows is I feel like we're gone to an age of entertainment that might be good, might be bad. We just don't know. But it's definitely finding ways for 1,000 different types of media and shows and stories to get out there that would never happen in the classic, can we serialize this? Will people pay attention to it? Or does it fit into the advertiser's pocket as workable? And I think a video game like No Man's Sky is a really hard sell. A TV show like The Crown's a really hard sell. Even with the Royals angle, you know, how can you keep that up? That sort of thing. Those things are going to be hard to do. Even something with the cachet of like Watchmen, like, you know, doesn't have as far to go, because superheroes are such a big thing now. So it'd actually be harder to pitch a show that's probably like a Western nowadays, because Westerns are no longer Westerns and spy stuff, which used to be a big thing in the Cold War, are now pop culturally replaced with superheroes. Mm-hmm. And it's all incorporated, but at the same time, it's interesting. So I just, it's fascinating that in this era that's, we definitely still adapt the same types of stories. It's the classic, there's, you know, 6 or 7 basic plots for every story. But at the same time, it's how you watch it and what is important in what you're taking in. And sometimes for some people, it's literally the journey. Like it does not matter if the ring gets to Mordor. People really, 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 really like to hear about music and food along the way. And sometimes that's all they want.
Right.
And I think in a lot of ways, that's great, because there's certain TV shows that definitely, we all know that once you get to the end of a great epic, like the endings are really hard to stick. So if you don't make it more about the journey and the people, then it can be really difficult. What's funny is I would almost segue to like, I've loved this TV show called Friday Night Lights, which is about a high school football team.
I have seen them all.
And I'm a sports. You saw Friday Night Lights?
Loved it. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's awesome to hear, because I was nervous, because in the past, like some things I was like, you know, Joe, I think Joe would like this. Joe would like this. You're like, I absorbed some of it. It was not great. Or I was not as drawn into it. I was like, oh, damn it. I can never hit Joel with a good recommendation. So you've already seen it. So at least we have that in common. But like, complete opposite of what we were talking about. That show is not about bleakness. It's about believing that at heart, people are legitimately good. Like, people make mistakes, people make bad choices, and there are people out there who are still not going to be good people, but for the most part, people care about other people. And that was a great show. And then you had The Sports Lens, and I was super into that. And like, it was just one of the shows that I felt, because it was more about the people and the characters, that the sports just augmented it and brought it to a new level for me. Whereas if you didn't care about football, I think you could just care about it, because that just allows you to have a plot climax is the game. But the real climax is this person going to make the right choice, or is this person going to yada, yada, yada. And so one of the things I found interesting is like sort of good people and that sort of mentality of like the dreamer and that sort of thing. And I've seen that in a lot of animes recently, and I brought it up already on this episode, but My Hero Academia has it, but that's about superheroes. So of course I love it. But there's this show that caught me off guard, and I got to give my buddy Adam Cobb credit for it. Who also got me on My Hero Academia, called Haikyuu. That's the way it's pronounced. I asked him, but it's spelled Haiku, and then IMDb wants it to have another U into exclamation points. Anyway, it's a high school boys volleyball team. Now, when my buddy Adam told me about it, I was very resistant. I was not super interested in it. But the thing about it that I find engaging is that the sport is important, and it is almost entirely about the sport. There's not a lot of the worries about grades or girls or their family life that you get from a Friday Night Lights. So if you're not super into the sport of volleyball, maybe you won't like it. But here's the thing. I didn't know anything about volleyball, and they do a good job of kind of telling you about it, and you really get into it because these people are genuinely, these kids are genuinely excited about doing it. And of course, you have this way too short kid who wants to be a spiker and into this volleyball team. And he has that like, just that optimism. And when he gets knocked down, he picks himself back up in the same way that you fall in love with in your animes and your cartoons and that sort of thing. And so I really got into it. The sports angle, of course, the competition got to me. And I find that really engaging, but it's good. They finally put, it was on Hulu. They put two seasons on Netflix with subs and dubs. I do dubs. Cause I don't like to read. Sorry. But anyway, it's really good. I highly recommend it. I don't need to get too far into it, but it's just a fun show where it's not about, I mean, God, people have crushes in it, but it's not about all the like goofy, like borderline double entendres you get from a lot of animes, even some of my favorites that have it all over the place. And it's not about, it's not Yu-Gi-Oh level of like nasty villains wringing their fingers. Like, I even complained to my buddy Adam, like the other teams they play in crucial matches, they almost go out of their way to show how the other people on the other team, like, got there and why they're there and why they're playing. And like, so there's almost a sense of like, oh, you don't want them to lose, but you also like really want your guys to win. Like, they're your team, you know, these people, and you get to see them adapt and be better and trying to be better at the game and that sort of thing. It's not super complex. There's not a lot of depth to it. Again, they're not, I mean, there was one episode in which they really had to worry about their grades. And other than that, it was entirely about volleyball and getting better at it. But it's one of those shows, like when you're talking about with No Man's Sky and with The Crown, where you're like, I just watch it and I get invested because it's fun just watching people try and be really good at something. And then if they're not good at it, like, they don't get angry. They don't like blame everybody else. And there's, I mean, yes, there's some of that. They're high school kids, but there's still this element of hope, and there's this element of trying. And trying to get better. And it really is engaging for me. So there's 25 episodes per season. Sort of some cliffhangery stuff, not total DBZ level of like, you know, one game takes like 50 episodes, but there have been a few like crucial games they play where it's like 4 or 5 episodes. But overall, it's fun, it's light, and it's one of those shows where I definitely feel like, I don't know. I really enjoy it. It's the same way of like, my tastes are changing. If you told me I would just watch a show that's just pretty much just people playing volleyball, like I'd be like, oh, that's really fun. And like 15-year-old me would be like, well, is it a girls volleyball team? And like me, even like 10 years ago, have been like, well, is it like volleyball is an excuse for them to use like the dark realms to like summon dragons and fight each other? But like now where I am in my life, I'm like, it's just about them playing volleyball. And that's interesting to me. So I highly recommend that one. It's spelled HAIYKU exclamation point from what I've seen on Netflix. Haikyuu. Just a good anime. It's not very tropey or stereotypey from what the genre is overall with all the extra stuff. Like I think it's pretty much all ages appropriate. And if people find that interesting, then go for it. But thanks, Adam, for that recommendation. And I'm really looking forward to trying to watch some more of it.
Nice. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we have for this episode of The Citadel Cafe. You can find out more about the show at thecitadelcafe.com. The music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. You can, of course, email us at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. That includes iTunes, Android, Stitcher, and Spotify. But, of course, spreading the show around via word of mouth is the best way to support. It's free. You just tell people that, hey, I really like this show, and you might like it too. But one of the great things about the show is that you didn't hear any advertisements because we're 100% listener supported. So if you'd like to contribute, head on over to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. And if you find a value in the show, please consider putting a little bit of value back into it. Base level is $1 a show, which is less than a latte a month. So if you think that that's worth it to you, then you can sign up at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe and get things like member only Discord access, and bonus episodes. We talk about all kinds of stuff in the background during the week. The Discord is a fun, fun, nerdy place. We are down 2 patrons from last month, so the hill to get to one more patron for next month has grown larger. But hopefully one or two or maybe 3 of you will consider supporting the show. I would very much appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners would as well. You can find me at joelduggan.com. That's where I hang my illustration and design hat. That's also where I have links to other podcasts I do, like The Spawn Chunks, which is all about Minecraft, and also links to things like twitch.tv/joelduggan, which is where I'm playing a lot of No Man's Sky right now. So if you want some chill space experience, come hang out and we'll have some fun. Brockett, where can people find you and what you are doing online?
You can just look for at the Cat Vulva on Instagram or Twitter. I don't tweet that much, but my Instagram used to have, well, does still have hashtag Canny of This Day, which I talked about last time I was on the show. I wrapped up last month of 31 different or more than that candies or anything, but that's generally where it is. That's mostly what I do now.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick 2.